Today, it's Edwin's Monday Evening Property Rant. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news. Can you believe it? Monday's come around again, and Edwin has come back again for another rant. Edwin, welcome back.
Well, we're just barely on, Martin. We're just barely on. We're getting obstacles and hurdles from all sides, I think. The mainstream don't like our post. The industry don't like our post. The construction and building sector are upset with our post. So I think they're going to they've dobbed us into e-current. So the internet's slow and my computer keeps on playing up.
Well, you know, it's the high tech. I reckon the ban next was it Wednesday or something, you know, is really playing havoc with a few things. But anyway, we are on, so there's a lot to talk about. And I just wanted to sort of kick the conversation off a little bit left of center, insofar that I just picked up this the other day, which I thought was quite an interesting statement about, well, you know, the amount of debt that's being racked up in Australia is equivalent to around $1,700 per person, you know, which is actually quite a lot of money. And I made a show entitled "The Australian Economic Miracle Isn't," because I actually think that there's quite a lot of really interesting stuff going on at the moment, but a lot of it is not being told of in the sort of the mainstream, or indeed from the political perspective. Of course, Jim has just announced that they're not going to extend the electricity subsidies further. So that's going to conk out at the end of the year. And that's quite interesting in the context of the fact that household spending, well, superficially at least, splurged over the last month. That was because of a lot of the cheap discounting from retail. But if you actually compare it with where we were back in 2003, it's only coming back to where it was then. So actually, a lot of households are beginning to find it quite difficult to be able to actually deal with this continuing pressure. And I noticed that there's a lot of now diversity in the reporting on the property side of things, with some people suggesting that everything is great and, you know, there's boom, boom, boom. But actually, if you look carefully, there are some interesting sort of early signals. There was this article that suggested that the home approvals look as though they're sliding back. There are lengthy and unpredictable approval processes for properties, which is part of the issue. Availability of property, of course. The auction results were somewhat down if you look at the clearance rates. So trying to make sense of this at the moment, Edwin, is quite complicated. That's where we need your help. So, you know, I don't know whether you can provide any light or whether there's any heat. The Darwin story is an indicator of what may or may not be in train with this article that you sent me. $100 million Darwin hotel development has been axed by its Singapore-based developer after traditional owners argued it would overlook a sacred site to a tawny owl. So how do you make sense of all this stuff, Edwin?
Well, all the points that you raised, Martin, as I keep on saying, is that it's orchestrated. It's too much. It looks too much of a political symphony, because there's no other way to put it. We're on a lockstep with those that have are going to have a lot more, and those that have not are going to have a lot less. To the point where we're really not creating the environment for young people to get into the market. We're not really creating the environment for the first home buyers to really look ahead. We're not creating the environment for our foreign investors to sink some real dollars into our economy, into the construction industry, where it's very much needed, and to provide jobs, to provide infrastructure, to provide accommodation for hospitality and tourism, which is what this nation's one of the four pillars of this nation. Tourism is, was one of the strongest pillars with, along with mining and the natural resources that we ship out. So we've got a situation where you've got these impasses now. You've got people are looking at what's being said, what's being done from Victoria onwards, and now into Darwin, and it's this development that. That you just shared, where the Singaporean developers are just pulling out, is because it's not so much that it's on the land where this sacred owl or whatever is meant to be the site of this sacred animal, but it overlooks it, so it's no longer on it. It just has to overlook a sacred site, and whiz bang, thank you, ma'am. That's it. You're out of the picture, and you can take your millions of dollars and go put it elsewhere. Maybe you can go put it in New Zealand, where they'll welcome you with open arms, because they need it more there than what we do, I'd imagine. So this is, and we're going to talk about other issues as well, where I come up with this whole. The prelogue to our show, and that is it's a symphony. It's a symphony, and at the moment, the head honcho, the one that's leading the orchestra, is the Labor government, and every other party is just following suit, just playing the instruments, going along with the pie, with the music. So you got to ask yourself the question: who is watching this symphony? Who is in charge of the symphony? Who put it all together? And it's definitely not the people, because everything that you've just raised earlier on as well, with the cost of living crisis, unless you're part of the machine, unless you're part of the political agenda, unless you're part of it, you're really not going to get anywhere. So therefore. Is it any wonder that 57% or so of the workforce are employed by the three levels of government, are public servants, if not more? NDIS keeps on growing. There's more money being thrown at government projects, and there's less and less entrepreneurs. There's less and less small business operators that are supporting the structure. So the question is, how long can this go on for before it really collapses? And how long can they sustain this this symphony? That how long can are people just prepared to sit on the sidelines and watch it? Because it's really not leading to anything other than a bunch of noise. Eventually, it's all been convoluted, and it's. But again, Martin, it's. Then we've got the stories of what I call wishful thinking, and is it what we've been saying all along? On the one side, you've got the government playing their tune, and then on the other side, you've got the construction lobbyists and the developers saying, "Hey, give me more before we start to build." I mean, and that's, I mean, yeah, I was looking at James's post on LinkedIn. That was a rather interesting article. I mean, everybody's talking about infill, and he's talking against the urban sprawl. When in actual fact, we don't want to live in high rise. We want to live in on a bit of land where we can enjoy the barbecues, and if you got that little bit of extra coin, have a pool in your backyard and enjoy a swim as well. I mean, this is where we're going. It's this whole push for high-rise development, but it would be a different story. We would be saying something differently if we knew how to build.
Oh, are we saying we can't build in Australia? It's interesting. If you look at the statistics, Edwin, we're actually building more houses per capita, as it were, than almost anybody else. And we've actually been consistently doing that for a long period of time. So, and we've got 1.3 million people in the construction industry last time I looked. And interestingly, there was some data that came out, I covered it in my earlier show, that showed that the productivity in the construction sector has gone backwards. So we're actually, despite the fact we got more people, despite the fact that we're building quite well on a per capita basis, it's taking longer to build, and it's taking not only longer, but it's more expensive to build because, of course, as we've said, if you build up, guess what? You've got to actually build down as well before you start. It takes a lot longer to build. And guess what? You also have a lot of problems with construction as well. Now, it's interesting that you've mentioned that the high-rise question, because Peter Tulip posted this. This is actually from him talking about an article in The Guardian. Apartments are being replaced by luxury mansions in inner suburbs. This happens when you don't allow more housing. So, he, of course, Peter Tulip is another of these. We want to actually have higher density. We need to build up, et cetera, et cetera. So he believes that planning is going to solve it. But it's fascinating here that we've got a situation where effectively old apartments are being effectively replaced by luxury mansions in inner suburbs. And that's the other point, because if you actually look at the economics of construction, if you can sell an apartment for 3 or 4 million or more, you can still make money. So actually, the economics of construction at the moment is flying directly in the face of housing affordability, because the last thing that you want to build are small, modular, high-rise at affordable prices, because you can't make money on those. And that's the fundamental dilemma that we've got. And the planning directions, and, you know, reduce the amount of light coming in, reduce the footprint, reduce the parking spaces, all of those things are making it harder and harder for any of those construction and developing organizations to be able to actually make any money on those smaller properties. They need to build big. And that means that if you've got $4 million to spend, you know, you can have a multi-million or billion-dollar project and the construction industry can make money. But normal people getting squeezed out once again. The policies are stupid.
Yeah, and again, in that article from James, and what Tulip goes on about, bangs on about as well, and they're all talking about the concept of mixed use development. I mean, the proponent of it, but mixed use development doesn't work. It hasn't worked. I've been exposing the pitfalls of mixed use developments over the Sydney landscape for many years now, and it's something that it may work every now and again, but it scarcely works when you've got when you spread them out over Parramatta Road or over the main roads where you can't even park anyway and stop and have a coffee. You wouldn't want to anyway on a busy road. So it's this whole planning wishful dream that they have. And again, the locals don't understand and don't want to live in high rise. The WeChat chatterers, of course, of the other ones that come from mainland China or even from Hong Kong or other parts of Asia, they're used to living in high rise developments shops and all other commodities at the bottom. But you've got to have those central hubs as well. Like you've got your Campsies, you've got your Canterburys, you've got your Ashfields, Hurstfields, Chatswoods, and that's why they work, because the demographics or the WeChat chatterers that occupy these buildings, they're used to it. They like to live in those sort of environment because they don't go home and cook. They it's cheaper in most cases to eat out all the time anyway. And who wants to cook? The younger generation, the students, don't want to cook anyway. So, but anywhere else where they try to instigate or start these developments, they just don't work. And now tell me, Martin, right from what's happened over the last 12 months, who's got the cojones, who's got the balls to go out there and start up a coffee shop? You know, who's got, you know, if family members or friends tell you that they're going to start a coffee shop or they're going to start a small business operation, you think they've been hit over the head with a hammer or something or a tile's fallen on their head whilst they were stepping out of the house and they've got a little bit of amnesia and haven't realised how costly it is to start up a small business now. But yet fundamentally, this was the backbone of of Australia with the SME. So they're being squeezed by all sorts of regulations, legislation, all sorts of red tape and every other tape as well, that and hurdles and that they have to run through. I mean, look, you look at some of the costs for small commercial units in the mid mountains or the lower mountains, right up to Katoomba. I mean, it's insane. You're paying more per square meter in a commercial unit to have anything, like to have a shop front in the mountains, than what you do in the heart of the city. This is craziness, right? And then it's all the added costs. Then it's all the plus, which we're also going to touch on. So the developments that they're proposing, they just don't work. So when you read that article from James, I mean, it works in certain parts. I'm not saying they don't always work, but it just works in certain areas, and they have to be specific areas where you can. Who wants to drive down Parramatta Road, and you stop. You can't stop in most of the way from Parramatta Road into the city anyway. You've got limited parking spaces. I mean, and you got to go into a side street to then walk around the corner and then sit in the cafe. I mean, you only just have to go down the main roads of the central hubs, and you'll see how many vacancies there are, how many shop vacancies there are, how many for lease signs you see posted up. I mean, in Albo's own area, his own in Marrickville, you just go down Marrickville Road and you see all the four leases signed there. How it's devastating. And now you've got these changes as well to do with gas and everything around Maryland. They're having a hard time. The old shops there, they're not going to get upgraded. Well, the gas lines aren't going to get upgraded. And you've got 1,001 pizza shops. You've got kebab shops also that are relying heavily on gas. And they're having major issues. And there, to get a shop that has a fully functional gas facility, you're paying $4,000 a week. I mean, how many kebabs and how many za'atar pizzas do you have to sell to make that just to pay the rent? And then there's your staff and everything else that goes with it. So it's plus. So it's not making it any easier. Now, you mentioned about there's more construction per capita happening. Well, the thing with that, Martin, is that once you've got a DA and once you start, let's say you put a hole in the ground, you've triggered the DA, you've triggered the development application, but it doesn't mean that you're going to finish. So basically, you've triggered it, and then it's you don't lose your DA. So you've got some parts. It's 4 years to 5 years in order to get started with your development. But that's what's been happening. So people have got DAs. They've got DAs to do all sorts of things. Put extensions on homes, put duplexes up, do this, that, and the other. But the advantage, all you need to do is just drive a pole or just dig a hole or start, right? Basically, you have to some sort of starting point, and then you've triggered the DA. So now that's counted as construction, but it's not really, because it's not final. As I keep on saying in many of my posts across many social media platforms, and that is that it's not, don't count the startups, count the finishes. That's what you've got to count, to make it sense. Hence the reason why you've got this the government leading. Oh yeah, but we've got this. We're doing this. We're doing that. Yeah, you've started. When is it going to finish is the main question. When are the projects going to finish so people can move in? It's not happening. That's the critical factor, Martin, that a lot of people miss.
Well, that's why this productivity number is so important, right? As I said, if you look at actually the productivity, in other words, how much is actually produced, so this is the end of the process, it's falling. In fact, the construction industry itself is less productive than it was back in the last century, which is pretty remarkable. And it's a symptom of what Tarek Brooker calls the burnout economy. And in fact, I made a show saying the latest GDP's numbers shows the burnout economy is there in action. And if you want to get to the heart of it, here it is. This is actually the filled jobs by sector split out between the private jobs. That's the market, the private jobs market. That's excluding the government-aligned sectors and the government-reliant jobs. And the direct jobs, which are actually in the public sector, including those that are actually private sector jobs in government-aligned industry sectors. That's according to IFM. And you can see there that if you go back from 2023 to now, you can see that pretty much all of the growth, pretty much all of the growth is in those direct public sector jobs. In other words, the economy has been supported by government spending, in other words, taxpayer money, and that's true at the state as well as the federal level. So that's the first angle on this. What it means is that we're investing less and less in the more productive sections of the economy, the private sector, where there is actually opportunity to create real growth momentum. And just coming back to the other angle on this one, Edwin, that you mentioned as well, if you're a small business, I see that in my surveys, it is harder and harder and harder to keep that small business running because the red tape continues to get worse and worse and worse, and the compliance issues get worse and worse and worse. But the cash flow gets even more adverse. And in fact, quite a lot of small businesses are now saying, well, I don't see how I'm going to continue to trade next year. And particularly if you're in the retail sector or if you're in the hospitality sector, a lot of the sandwich shops and those sorts of things are definitely up against it. But I also note that a lot of construction sector firms, for example, the small ones, are also collapsing. Why? Because the cash flows don't work for them either. And I think this is the critical thing. So we've got this crazy situation where you've got our politicians saying, our policies are working, real jobs growth is happening and everything's fine and, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look, inflation's higher, public debt's higher, the amount of tax that people are paying is higher. Oh, and by the way, just to add a little bit of insult to injury, of course, the latest data on the cash rate predictions suggests that the next rate move is going to be up, and there's almost a 100% chance by November 26 that cash rates will be higher than they currently are. So the idea of the RBA cutting dramatically, we'll hear the RBA tomorrow, they'll probably sit on the sidelines tomorrow, suggests that in fact it's going to be quite unlikely that we're going to see interest rates coming back lower. So that's really the really big conundrum. And yet, and this is the interesting sort of counterpoint, this article that I saw made the point that Australia is seen as the second safest country in the world after the Netherlands. Actually, the US isn't in the top 15. And that, of course, puts a lot of interest from people out there in the rest of the world looking at Australia and saying, well, you're still not as bad as a lot of other people. And, you and I have been speaking about demand coming from the overseas quarter. Well, here's the reason. Australia is seen as a safe and secure society, despite all of the ructions that we've been talking about. And that's going to put extra demand on property because migration is going to be very high. It's still higher than it was. The national accounts actually that came out this last week confirmed that what we knew, that inflation is high, but also we also saw that migration is also running hot again. And interestingly, there was an interesting survey when we saw this, but this is actually from the Resolve Political Monitor. And basically there was a question here about whether you would support restricting permanent migration only to people of working age. 48% said yes, and 32% were neutral, 20% opposed that. Restricting permanent migration only to those people with skills we need, 61% said yes, we should do that. Pausing any immigration until our housing situation's caught up, 64% said yes, 23% were undecided. Only 13% said that, no, you should continue the immigration story. So the truth is that the immigration policies run by the government are not in line with the people out there in the country because more and more people are now opposing those policies. And I think that's very significant, Edwin, very significant.
Yeah, look, it's very significant, but at the end of the day, it comes back to what happens on voting day,
Yes.
and people seem to have a very, very short memory. That's why I say, look, I'm putting it out again. You can stone me, you can do whatever you want, but you've got to catch me first. The thing is, don't be surprised if the same party that is ruling right now are going to rule us in the next election moving forward as well. And then again, you've got to ask yourself, is the other side of the coin any better than the one that we've been dealt with today? Is the other wing of the vulture any different, or are they going to taper down? They are not going to taper down, Martin. I don't look from right now from the data points that we have, as I've mentioned over and over again for many years. Dusty is very well connected with the legal fraternity, with from the immigration side, and we have broken a lot of news that the mainstream have taken anywhere between 8 to 12 months, even 15 months, to catch up on what Dusty has shared with me and what I've shared over the years. On our show, and we've been well and truly up there. So right now, the data points in the conversation is not around tapering down. The data points and the conversations are around changing the visa class. You may have a reduction in students. Everybody's going to be happy. Let's go and clap our hands and praise the government. But on the other side, we're going to have an increase in what the government needs, and that is they need people to pay more taxes, right? So who are the people that are going to pay more taxes after you squeeze the juice and the blood, every drop of blood out of the local citizens? Is the foreigners, by way of land tax, by way of vacancy tax, by way of impost, by way of stamp duty, by way of the favourite fix that the pollies enjoy, and that is the we've got to come up with a good term for it. For the stamp duty fix, we've got to come up with a good term for it. But because that is what oils the machine. That is what greases the cogs. That is what that is what makes the Aldi and the brown paper bags keep on rotating amongst the crowds. So this is there's no other there's no two ways about it, Martin. So when you squeeze the juice and you squeeze the life out of the local Aussies, you've got to start looking elsewhere. We've got 4 billion people, 4 billion, not million, billion people. 6 hour from 6 hour flight away from or 8 hour flight away from Sydney, and Australia's population is 26 million. Properties on market currently, homes on market currently in Sydney is what around 8,000. And if you really want to get more, and you get spoiled, but obviously you've got to take other precautions. You can go to Melbourne, and they've got closer to 20,000. So it's not a big market. So, and then you've got what I've been also banging my head against the brick wall sometimes with some of the commentators online, and that is that they think that every investor, every property purchaser is buying on yield. They're not buying on yield. They're buying on the security. If we are the second safest nation, out of in the, we sit second in to be in the top 15. I mean, it's no news to us, to you and me. It's no news to our followers and our viewers, and hence the reason why a lot of the property purchases around Sydney don't make sense, because they're willing to pay, tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, in extra stamp duty, extra taxes. Why? Because they want to park their money. Two, they want to. They can somewhere to they feel safe, and they put their they're looking for that long-term PR, permanent residency, and it's the pathways for permanent residency for the professions that we need. I mean, the quickest and the quickest pathway is medicine, the medical pathway, And under that pathway, as I said before, you could get a certificate from abroad saying that you're a masseur, with or without a happy ending, and a massage therapist, and you can get PR. So as long as you can prove that you've had that certificate for 2 years. So there you go, Martin. So all these things are at play. But it's interesting to note that they're finding it hard for the developers to really start building, because that is what they're really salivating over is construction. Construction has to start. The high rises have to start. By hook or by crook, they will get them started. And if it means, as I said and as I predicted over 18 months ago, that that developers are going to be cash funded or partly funded, whatever they're going to do, whatever gift they're going to get, they're going to get it. They're waiting for it. They will not put shovel to the ground until that comes through. And that is the stamp duty fix. If you recall what, we basically became, the politicians became addicts of the stamp duty from back in 2012. Even before then, 2009, 2010, when the FIRB reduced the standards, watered the standards down to be able to sell an entire block to overseas investors. I mean, that was it. That's when we let this beast loose. But it's been contained at the moment, and now. They've got to let it loose again in order to get that, because otherwise, what else are they going to do? I mean, they're already taxing pets, or they're about to tax pets in Victoria. What else can they, mowing lawns, I guess, or they'll come to your place and count the blades of grass on your front lawn, and then they'll tax you on that. Who knows what they're going to tax them? But they've got to bring in, as I said, they've got to bring in new blood. They've got to bring new lambs. Because the locals don't want to live in high rise. They don't want, they're renting them because they've got no choice. And some are buying them out of sheer desperation for needs, for medical reasons, for schooling reasons, for whatever reason. They're being forced into these dog boxes that, if you recall, there's about 58 or 59. Or thereabouts, buildings in Sydney that have not been disclosed that still have flammable cladding, and there's a hell of a lot more that shouldn't be, it shouldn't have any occupants in them because of the major issues that they have. So this is what we have, but all we keep on, seeing is more and more regulation, more legislation, more hurdles. More obstacles for small business operators to keep on feeding this machine. And of course, there's going to be a lot of pain, and there's going to be a hell of a lot more pain to come. And this is the sad thing about watching all this in real time on the ground is the fact that you, from your surveys, myself, from my experience and my on the ground chats with different people and different across the industry, we see it. And we live it, but the politicians don't. They don't see. They live in their ivory little towers in Buckingham Palace down in Canberra.
Well, just going back to Victoria, I'm sure you've seen this, but there was an article here that suggests that Victorians face an extra $1.7 billion of a tax bill, and the interest payments to service debt will continue to rise, and therefore the debt per household will continue to rise. And that's one of the reasons why Victoria, I think, is seeing the property market so weak. All of the data that I'm seeing suggests that price rises are very anemic at best and only partial. A lot of people are still selling at a loss, and more people are still trying to get out. And there are promised $4 billion worth of state savings, maybe, but Labor has done nothing to better Victoria's budget is the headline. And I think that probably really just brings out this problem of too much debt around the place. And it's not just Victoria, but Victoria's leading the way, right? So Victoria seems to me to be the harbinger of what's going to happen. Victoria's had the most anemic price growth over recent years. We've seen more people try to get out and move to other parts of the country. We've seen more property investors leave from Victoria simply because of the extra rules and regulations. All of those things are very much in play. And just come back to your political point, there was this Wall Street headline. Actually, there were two headlines side by side, which were quite interesting, right? On the first one was, the world has more billionaires than ever, with soaring tech valuations and stock market gains boosting the number of billionaires and the wealth that they hold. But on the other hand, this is the US, the majority of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And this is a good example of what I call the K shape. So there are some doing really well, there are some doing really badly. And of course, politicians tend to be in the, well, I'm sitting pretty, thank you. I'm enjoying my life, and you know, I can spend a lot of money traveling around the world on the government to pay. Because of course, the story of a recent trip by a certain politician to the US was $100,000, and a few other places too. There's this problem that we've got an us and a them, and you made this point actually later on in the show, and it's worth just reiterating. The trouble is that most ordinary people might aspire to be in the billionaire bucket and sit there with lots of money in shares and property. But actually, most people are actually in the other side of the coin, where they're really caught and are trapped with this pressure to spend. Real spending, of course, as I said, was up, but it was more up because of the cheap deals that were being done there. In real terms, spending is not really very flash. Real incomes are still where they were some years ago. So a lot of people are not seeing any significant momentum in the right direction. And that's the real problem. And yet the people who are leading the charge, the politicians, are in a completely different world. And you know, that until this changes, we're not going to see much in the way of change of momentum or attitude. So we're going to see this continued pressure on housing affordability. We're going to see this continued discussion about, we'll do lots of things to help people, but actually what we're doing really, look at the first home grants, we're helping people to get in, but that's just putting more pressure. And there was an article I saw that suggested that some of those people that are actually being offered this 5% way in are closer to bankruptcy within 12 months than ever before, because they've got no wriggle room, and the spending on the mortgage is an even greater share of their income. So it's nuts. So we have a real big problem. But you know, we're not going to solve it tonight, Edwin. But it's worth just calling it out and saying, yeah, despite all of that, we've got a big set of questions. But there's another set of questions relating specifically to the property industry, and particularly property managers. And I think it's probably worth us spending a bit of time just kicking that around as well.
Look, and you could say it's not just necessarily property managers. We've talked about it before, but it's now very, very prominent. And that is outsourcing. This whole thing of outsourcing, and which is putting a lot, which also puts a lot more pressure on the local businesses, and can put a hell of a lot more pressure in the real estate industry in 2026, as we're going to talk about a little bit more as well. But yeah, the outsourcing phenomenon is, yes, you can save, businesses are trying to save money in order to stay afloat, and they're trying to outsource a lot of the mandatory and the obligations that businesses have. I mean, from accounting, trust accounting to managing the files, information, the whole bit. But this came across my one of my foods, and that was to do with this Property Assist was a sponsored because it's sponsored. I can share it because I didn't want to see it, and they put it through one of my feeds, so I'm sharing it now. And it says save $80,000 overhead and get an on-demand property inspection support. From Property Assist. So basically, it's taking away the duties or so-called making it easier for property managers to do their job. But what it actually does, it's counterproductive because you don't have to see what's happened to the property management sector over the last 10 years. when a lot of outsourcing started happening, and even just before that, when a lot of good property managers jump ship from the property management side to sales because you know, they weren't being looked after, and obviously they saw the colleagues earning a lot more by way of the, you know, off the plan sales, and it was a bonanza, and then they just jumped ship. So what we've got now is we've got a transition, and I'm sure that this is happening across other industries as well. In order for business to save costs, they're outsourcing a lot of their in-house duties. That could potentially you know, bite them in the backside in the future. So now you've got property managers, you know, they're no longer recognizing their tenants. They don't have that communication. That's a whole point of a property manager, is to manage the property, to know the tenant. You are the conduit between the tenant and the landlord and the investor. They won't recognize the properties because they seldom now set foot in the properties, and a lot of properties are in, you know, needing a lot of maintenance. They're in disrepair. The property managers just saying that they're not proactive, you know, in the reporting, because a lot of them really don't know how to manage. A lot of them are very young, come from a you know, and guess what? And a lot of the industry. The last week's chatter amongst the industry was the rising problems and pressures that have been put on property managers, because that's affecting their daily life in the psychological well-being and so forth. I mean, but is it any wonder? Because you're looking for the cheapest option. So if you're looking for the cheapest option, you've got to be looking for the youngest option. And then you're going to be outsourcing. They're not really going to be trained properly, because property management has become like a second tier job in the industry. When in actual fact, property management is the heart, is the backbone of the entire industry, and that's how it was for many, many decades. And now we've sort of spun that around. And the ones that take prominent place are the ones that beat the chest and show the big ticket sales on the weekend, and you know, beat the chest. And I was going to say something else. You know, show us how big of a signboard they've got, you know, with a big sold sign in the front yard. So they've lost contact with the tenants. They've lost contact with the actual property. Now they've also lost custody of the file. Of valuable information, of important information, of you know, very, very sensitive information in a lot of the cases. And they're really opening up themselves for major insurance problems down the track, as we'll talk about it a little bit later on in the chat. So that's what, yeah, but on the one hand, you can't blame small business operators for trying to outsource things in order to reduce costs, in order to even keep the staff that they've got, because otherwise it becomes very, very hard to maintain the staff. And then if you don't maintain your staff, you don't maintain your level of service. And if you don't maintain your level of service, people go elsewhere in order to get the, you lose the custom, and then you lose business, and then eventually have to close your doors anyway. So they're the real pressures out there, Mark. Now, you talked about earlier on the pressure of those that jumped on with a 5% the freebies that the government handed out, and the reports on, you know, how in I think news.com brought out that article on, you know, thousands of homeowners forced to weigh selling homes they can no longer afford. Now, look, I read through the article. And I started looking at other posts as well, and looking at what they were saying. But look, at the end of the day, Martin, it comes back to a number of things. Look, okay, of course they're forced to weigh whether or not they sell. But whether or not they sell is another question, right? And I don't believe that the people that are caught up in this situation are just going to sell willy-nilly. They're going to bear a lot more pain before they sell. If anything, as we said before in the show, they're cutting down costs and even meals in order to stay put, in order to try and ride this, this hellish moment that they're going through at the moment presently. Obviously, if they sell, where do they go? Where do they relocate to? Can they buy back in? More than likely, they won't be able to buy back in because the bank criteria has changed since they originally bought. And further to that, in Sydney, and I'm just talking for Sydney, listing numbers have to really dramatically increase. They have to, in some instances, more than double in order for markets to be affected because of the demand that we, and the demand, the pressure that demand is put from all other sides, from foreign investors, people wanting to park their money, people looking at Australia to migrate to people looking for job positions in Australia in order to be able to migrate freely. Expats coming back home because of the shit show that's happening all over the world presently, and we're still somewhat keeping away from all that. So, and we're really not a big market. So, I think a lot has to happen before we start seeing prices drop. But the sad part and the reality is that there's a hell of a lot of pressure, and you can only put it to the fact that Aussies can put up with a lot of shit, and they put up with a lot of pressure. We've got this knack to be able to put up with a lot of pressure before we break, and that's the only thing that's keeping them there. But what other choices do they have, Martin?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Where do they go? And I've had that conversation many times from my one-to-one conversations. But the Canstar report that this article was based on did make a couple of really interesting points. Firstly, the Canstar head of research, Sally Tyndall, said intent didn't always translate into action, but the signal was significant. I think you're spot on as you highlighted that. The primary motivations were downsizing and upgrading, but a concerning 19% said they were contemplating a sale because they couldn't afford higher loan repayments, and housing costs now outrank other essential expenses and are more than double the concern they were 5 years ago, eclipsing groceries, energy bills, insurance premiums, and movements in house prices. And that's certainly consistent with my surveys. A lot of people are still in significant cash flow pressure. But one of the things that I want to underscore in terms of those pressures, the cost of insurance on houses, that has gone absolutely through the roof, particularly in some areas exposed to the beaches or the bushfires. And it's worth just reflecting on that in the light of what's happened in the last few days with the bushfires up north of Sydney and down in Tasmania. Insurance costs are actually now biting quite hard, not uniformly, but in some areas. And so one of the things that I think people need to be clear about when they think about buying is getting some information on insurance costs, because those insurance costs are now dramatically higher. And of course, if you have a mortgage, you have an obligation to hold insurance against the building at very least. So that's another thing to just bear in mind. But these pressures are going to continue. Like I said, interest rates probably not going to come down much further. Incomes in real terms, not really moving up that much too. So we are in for the long run. And as you say, because people have very little in the way of other options, you know, they can't get into the rental section because, well, rents are just too high. So they're going to actually do all they can. That includes putting more on credit cards. That includes cutting back on other expenditure categories, all of those things. And we're seeing that in spades in the surveys that we run. Now, the other interesting observation is that the rental sector is still showing some grief. And this article that you've shared, Aussie tenants face $10,000 rent hikes as landlords told to raise the price. And quoting Louis Christopher there about forecasting an increase in rents across Australia's capital cities next year. But the battle is looming as the nation's preeminent property investor lobby groups call for landlords to push rents higher when they can to combat government taxing them more heavily. And a nationwide home building scheme aims to put the brakes on rents. So you've got now this really the heart of the conversation here. Who is actually putting rents up really, Edwin? This is a really important article.
This is, look, it's it, is it who's or what's the cause? The because if we took away the current government policy, and we go back to the start of the show, the government listened to the general public, well, we wouldn't be in this position, or we would start to look for solutions. We can't look for solutions if you just keep on, you keep on putting dynamite in the dam. If you keep on throwing dynamite into the on the other side of the dam, it's going to continue to crack. And so, look, the sad thing is, Martin, that no one's really listening to the surveys. No one's really listening to the people. And the way that the government has manipulated the people to get the majority on side is obviously by making them a part of the deal, a part of the orchestra that is playing the symphony. Whether it be you're going to listen, you're just going to stand in the back row and you just got the triangle, and every now and again you just tap on the triangle. Whatever your role is, whatever however insignificant it is, you're going to get paid handsomely, because whilst you're getting the wage, whilst you're getting that income from in the public sector, you're really not going to upset the apple cart, are you? And when the majority of the population is employed by the public sector, well, how much are you going to really fight against the conductor? You're not really going to fight, right? You if anything, you're going to sit down, put your head down, and you're just going to keep on playing your little triangle or whatever it is, or your little maraca every now and again when you get told to, because you don't want to upset that apple tree. And then, do you blame the people for not taking part or not standing up? Because they've also got families, they've also got debts, they've also got mortgages, and that was the only way that they themselves could get a bank loan in order to buy a property, whether it be a hole in a building, or whether it be a house on a bit of land. So these are the hard decisions. So really, and the government, I guess the government's position is my facetious way of looking at it, is the fact that they've got no choice. They've got no choice but to bring in the dollars, and they've got to bring it in from abroad, stymie, whatever. But that's the my assessment of Dusty's information points to us, and what she brings, and what she's and she so far she hasn't been wrong. It's a hard one, mate. But then, and then look at my predictions as well from earlier in the year. I call that there will be fires in the northern beaches. Okay, they're a little bit further than the northern beaches, but I call it now. We need to expect is the floods. I think that was prediction number 10. But you only have to look at what was being played out in other parts of the world to then just sort of think, okay, are they going to try the same shit in our part of the world as well? As I said, that's my facetious way of looking at things. My conspiracy theorists, putting my conspiracy theory hat on, we're basically emulating what others have already done. And if we're going to go down that path, it's because it's the same the same conductor that's moving those orchestras abroad and playing those symphonies are the same ones that eventually are going to be unmasked, and we're going to be able to see as to who's taking us down what path. So the unfortunate thing is, that the pressure is going to continue to be on the rental market, like you and I have been talking about, on the renters, on the rental people that make up the rental pool. It's not going to make it easier for backpackers or anybody else to come in as well, or those, you know, on working visas that from essential services that we need as well, like you're historically. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed. I forgot the fact that you're over in England. But for the last couple of weeks, you know, I mean, Dusty and I, we love our watermelons. And bloody hell, you're paying $12 for a quarter of a watermelon. That's insane. Why? Because, you know, they're basically rotting in the watermelon plantations because nobody can pick them. It's hard to get them to the, you know, to the fruit shops, and then every other fruit as well that we once enjoyed at very low prices. You know, apples. I've been looking around. I mean, I love apples, and I've been looking around, and I mean, we're paying $9 a kilo now for things that we were paying 18 months ago. It was only, you know, $2.50, $2.80. It's crazy. And then you know, Dusty and I can have the pleasure of having these more regularly, but what about the families that can't? What about the, you know, the kids that they, you know, they, you know, it's scary and sad at the same time, Mark. It's a scary world that we're moving into.
Oh, it is, absolutely. And I had a conversation last week with John Wright, who's actually at UTS, and we're talking there about the root cause of the property crisis, because there is a crisis. And his argument is deliberate. There are lots of parties involved, from government and the banks and everything else. But he thinks that the subsidy of the investment market in particular is a root cause. And he talks about the carry trade that creates. And he says, look, those property investors, the mum and dad investors, from one lens look perfectly benign and, you know, doing the logical thing. But from another perspective, they're actually part of the problem. But the point is, if you are actually in the system, you will try and do the best that you can within the system. And that's what people are doing. So people are actually leveraging up and buying property because, well, frankly, that's the way it's been for some time. And, you know, it will continue. Or if you're in the rental sector, you've got no choice but to pay the higher rents, because if you're in the system, you've got to be part of the system. You can't just vote with your feet and be outside it. And that's the problem. So people are a bit trapped at the moment with all of this. And we'll continue to be trapped because there's nothing fundamentally going to shift from a government policy perspective, I think, on some of those critical things. And it's interesting, this article here was from an outside interview. So this was a woman who came from the UK and, you know, basically said, oh, people thinking of moving to Australia, well, it's not easy. Sydney rental crisis is no joke, she said. So basically people are beginning to realise that you can come to Australia, but you've got to then play by the Australian rules. And the Australian rules, of course, is rentals are very, very, very expensive. So, you know, no simple solution from moving from the UK to Australia, because it's pretty broken in the UK, but it's pretty broken in Australia too. So just as we were recording the show, Edwin's audio stopped. So I'm just going to take you through the numbers now. We'll start with looking at Sydney. So on the 1st of December, there were around 22,489 properties for sale based on domain, and that's on their definition of the Sydney region. On the 8th, 21,470. And you can see here that the trend is easing down. And if you take a look specifically less the land, you can see there the listings are actually off their peaks. In Melbourne, 29,341 on the 1st of December, compared with 28,641 on the 8th. So again, they're sliding down. And in fact, in Brisbane on the 1st, 3,195 compared with 3,015 on the 8th. And interestingly, just talking about Brisbane, I saw this data from Spaces that showed that the number of property listings in Brisbane region are rising quite fast, particularly with houses, whereas apartments and other types of property, not so much. And looking at the auction clearances, well, the auctions were actually still quite strong, but the clearances were down, as I said earlier on, and you can see that in the charts shown here comparing 24 with 25, that shows both are now somewhat down, as you'd expect as we come into the peak summer season. And looking at the rentals, we've got 12,538 in the Sydney region on the 1st, compared with 12,942 on the 8th, and 12,042 on the 1st, compared with 11,736 in Melbourne on the 8th. So that shows that things are definitely coming off the boil at this time. Unfortunately, Edwin has disappeared because the audio is not working anymore. So that's going to be it for tonight's show with Edwin. Thank you very much for listening to Edwin and I talking and ranting as normal. And hopefully we'll be able to fix the technology for next week. But this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Take care. See you later.